This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Several Western democracies armed Saddam Hussein, only to end up fighting him in the Gulf War. The war showed off America's new smart weapons, and now a lot of countries want to buy them. What effect has the Gulf War had on the arms race? My guest James Adams wrote about how dictators build their arsenals in his book Engines of War, Merchants of Death and the New Arms Race. He investigated covert military forces around the world in his book Secret Armies. Adams is also defense correspondent for the Sunday Times of London. I spoke with him earlier today from the NPR Bureau in London and asked him if international arms sales are up in the wake of the war.
I think it's a bit early to say yet, because you don't get the result of something like this for quite some time. What matters is, will the war increase or decrease the amount of arms sales over the next 12 months, couple of years? And the answer almost certainly seems to be yes, it will. But as far as the war itself is concerned, the significance of it is not its instant impact on arms sales, but how the war will alter the pattern of arms sales in the future, perhaps for the next decade or so.
Now, what about the countries who were our allies in the Middle East? Are we rewarding them for their support sending them more arms?
Yes, very definitely, because obviously we have a debt to pay, and people signed up on the coalition side, not because they necessarily thought the coalition was a wonderful thing, but because they saw some benefit, both political, economic, and military. So for countries like Saudi Arabia, they will be expecting fighter aircraft, tanks, minesweepers, and so on from the Allies. Whether they'll be simply from the United States or not remains to be seen, but they will expect that kind of payoff, just as Israel will expect a payoff for showing what it describes as restraint in not retaliating against Iraq.
Now, the Bush administration, I believe, wants to send about $14 billion worth of arms to the Saudis.
Yes, that's right. And it looks like that'll go through. I don't think there's going to be the congressional objections. This is an arms deal that's been in the works for ages, and Congress has been trying to prevent it under pressure from the Israeli lobby. It looks as if that's now not going to survive the war. So those arms will go through. In addition, you've got a $20 billion package from the British that will be going to Saudi Arabia. And so, in a sense, the war has freed up a lot of the deals that were in the pipeline, a lot of the political restraint, whereas some people, I think, had been hoping that what the war would produce would be more, not less, restraint.
Now, what about Turkey, Egypt, the United Arab Emirates, also countries who supported the United States and Britain? Are we sending them arms to maintain the balance of power and to support U.S. security objectives in the Gulf?
Well, we have agreed, this context, the United States has agreed to send Patriot missiles and fighter aircraft to Egypt. Turkey is going to get fighter aircraft. The UAE is looking for tanks and will probably get them, and is also looking for Patriots and will probably get those also. And that's just the sort of front-end stuff. And then there'll be plenty of other missiles, ground systems of one kind or another, new airfields, communications. So we're looking at across the board pretty comprehensive packages of arms, equipment, and support for almost all those countries that were involved. It remains to be seen whether Syria, a traditional ally of the Soviet Union, will come into the market from the West, but certainly the Soviets will want to be replacing and reinforcing the Syrian armed forces in the same way as we are with the Saudis.
Now, if the United States is sending weapons to these countries in the hope of keeping a balance of power that would be favorable to the United States, what are the risks here?
Well, I think the reward for doing this kind of thing is that you get political influence and cash or oil or whatever you sort of deal you do. The risk is that by arming, you actually make a non-aggressive country adopt an aggressive posture. They say to themselves, well, we've got all this wonderful death-dealing stuff. Let's see if it actually works. And as Iraq did, launch an attack upon a neighbor. So the argument, I suppose, is a very simple one, that the more weapons you supply, they are not, as some would have it, stabilizing and producing security in a region, but are actually very destabilizing. And you just end up with an accelerating cycle of each country needs to buy more arms to defend itself against an increasingly well-armed neighbor. And it's very difficult to break out of that cycle. And some had hoped that the Iraq war might provide an opportunity to do just that.
Do you think it's short-sighted for the United States to be sending high-tech weapons to countries that might be friendly to the United States now? These deals might look good economically for America right now, but there's always the chance that one of these countries will be the next Iraq, that it will turn from what the United States perceived as an ally to what the United States perceived as an enemy.
Yes, of course it's short-sighted, but then one has to deal with the real world. And I think it's impossible to say now who tomorrow is going to be the next ruler in, let us say, Saudi Arabia. I can write you a paper today saying that Saudi Arabia will have the same ruling family in 20 years' time. I can write you another paper just as convincing to say that the regime will fall in 6 months. And you just don't know. Now, all arms traffic has a risk attached to it. And the political world is all about short-term advantage and to hell with the long-term consequences. And the arms business is the absolute quintessential example of that. But it's reality we're dealing with. You can argue that you could actually manage the arms business better so that the risk was reduced and you tried to break away from this apparently endless cycle of proliferation. And that's a perfectly coherent argument. But you're never going to convince politicians not to be short-sighted. It kind of goes with the job.
If you're just joining us, my guest is James Adams, and he's the defense correspondent for the Sunday Times of London and the author of several books on terrorism, covert warfare, and the new international arms merchants. I was reading that 6 of the world's top 10 arms merchants are Western democracies. What's in it for the democracies who are sending arms besides the political manipulation that they hope to accomplish? What's in it financially?
Well, there's a lot of money involved because you get, let's say, Britain exported about $8 billion worth of arms last year. Now, for every dollar of gun or shell or whatever that you export, that's jobs back home, significant numbers of jobs in Britain. There are about 500,000 people employed one way or another in the defense industries. And so you're looking at political influence back home, because the politicians are able to say, well, we've got a thriving industry and industry is good and keeps the people happy. You also have got the value of getting the exports that where you sell arms, you get influence, and therefore hopefully you sell hospitals, if you like, or schools or other parts of the social infrastructure, which give you greater influence again. So it's not just a matter of here's a gun, give us the money. It's here's a gun, and that allows us to pass on other things and gives us significance back home. So there is a multi-layered argument of why arms sales are actually a good thing. There's equally counter-arguments that it's a bad thing. But still, there are very strong arguments why one should proceed, which is why in the last few years there's been a significant change in the way the arms business is run, where before it was a kind of dirty business and done by all sorts of seedy characters. These days, prime ministers and presidents are there to sign the deal themselves and play a very important role in setting them up, too.
Now, the Pentagon is planning to cut back on the defense budget. Does that mean that American manufacturers, American arms manufacturers, will want to approach more foreign clients to make up the difference?
Absolutely, and it's not just America. This is going to be a key factor of the arms trade for the next decade or longer, in that all countries are cutting back their defense budgets at the moment. So, for example, McDonnell Douglas, they make the F-15. The F-15 production line will be running out this year, next year. The next fighter replacement will not be coming in perhaps till 1996, somewhere in there. So in between, they've got to sell stuff, and they've got to sell them to countries abroad, obviously, because they haven't got a homegrown outlet. Now, they're just one. British aerospace in England. Same problem with the Tornado. The French with the Mirage, exactly the same problem. So you go around the world, and in each major arms producer for each different type of weapon, you're seeing orders falling from their indigenous outlets, their normal home outlets, and they have got then to export to survive, or they close. And they don't want to close, they want to survive. So they go out and they're all touting their business like mad and all competing very much with each other. And into that mix, you've got reductions of just standard equipment, for example, in the Eastern Bloc, where they're cutting their armed forces wholesale, and because of conventional arms treaties, similarly, weapons are coming onto the market. And all of this means that you've got a much, much more competitive arms trade than has ever really existed in the past. Cutthroat stuff, where people are saying, well, I'll give it to you for $100, now I'll give it to you for $80, I'll give it to you for $50, I'll give it to you if you give me some bananas in exchange. So it's a business that must, in the end, result in increased proliferation of all different types of weapons to whole new markets that are going to open up, which I think is a pretty worrying prospect.
Now, what are the illegitimate ways of getting weapons? And I guess this is where the arms merchants come in.
Well, in their case, the way arms exports are organized is that if you say they're in a warehouse in Miami, there is a supply of Stinger missiles. To take those missiles out of the warehouse in Miami and take them to Riyadh in Saudi Arabia, you have to get what is called an end-user certificate, which somebody in Saudi Arabia has to sign that certificate, some government official, to say, yes, I have ordered these missiles, I want them, and they're going to be used for my army. And on that basis, the export is allowed and the customs will allow them to leave. So the key thing in doing any illegal trade is to find some willing soul who will sign the end-user certificate for presumably a large sum of money. And instead of the weapons going to, let us say, Manila in the Philippines, which used to be a useful outlet for forged end-user certificates, instead of it going to Manila, it ends up in Afghanistan, say. Well, you can do that if you've got the end user certificate and you're not too fussy about breaking the law and paying out plenty of bribes. But the sort of money that you're talking about is so huge on some of these deals that there are enough corrupt officials around where there really isn't any problem, if that's the sort of business you want to do, in finding people to produce the fake documentation, and then you just need one of these venal characters who don't really care who they sell to and when to get on with the business.
Do arms merchants get some of their arms from United States sources too?
The U.S., in terms of complying with the law, is pretty good. It's the difficulty you get in terms of a country like the United States, where there is very high technology equipment that is available from, let us say, portable computers to guidance systems to microchips. You run into the difficulty of dual-use capability, where a particular item that I say is used to make soap suds, someone else of a less benevolent attitude may say, well, I can actually use this stuff to make chemical weapons. And that's the difficulty you get in a country like the US or in Britain, where a lot of dual-use equipment has been sent to a number of countries, and that's where the law is extremely weak and the control mechanism is not adequate.
If you're just joining us, my guest is James Adams, the defense correspondent for the Sunday Times of London and the author of several books on terrorism, covert warfare, and the new international arms merchants. We'll take a short break and we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. James Adams is my guest, the defense correspondent for the Sunday Times of London. Did the Gulf War change which weapons countries wanted most?
I think so, because what you saw in the Gulf War was the performance of high technology weapons, so-called smart weapons, and also of what the military call the standoff weapon, where essentially you're sort of out of visual sight and you fire something and you can guide it to its target a long way away. This is an attractive option because it keeps your own soldiers and airmen less vulnerable. So you've seen the apparently successful performance of a lot of very high technology equipment, which resulted in two things. One, the successful prosecution of the war by the coalition, and two, very, very light casualties on the coalition side. And both of those things will mean that you will have, they will be the preferred weapons of the future. This has been a trend, of course, that has been continuing for some time, but there's been a debate about should you go to the high-tech stuff because it's terribly expensive and does it work and so on, and why not keep low-tech and just have things that are fairly robust and will do the job. So you will see much more high-technology equipment coming onto the market, in part, of course, because the manufacturers will be able to say, here is this, it's been tested in battle and proved to work. Whereas the Soviets will be able to say this has been tested in battle and I'm afraid it didn't work very well. So there will be a change or a greater emphasis on high technology equipment as a result of the war.
There was testimony earlier this week at the House Armed Services Committee. Several scientists questioned the efficiency of the Patriot missiles they said that the exploded debris might have caused more damage than if the Patriot wasn't used at all. If there had been chemical weapons, the gas would have been spread more. The gas might have been more effective in killing people than it would have been if not for the Patriots. And basically, the use of the Patriot was questioned as a weapon in populated urban areas where the debris could, you know, knock down houses and kill people as well. What's your impression about that?
I think that's absolutely right, but then I don't think that's the whole argument. You can sit in some congressional committee and pontificate about these things, but the reality was at the time that Israel was being attacked, and indeed was Saudi Arabia, being attacked by these terror weapons coming out of the sky, which they would suddenly appear and hit populated areas. And the Israelis, quite understandably, were saying, this is intolerable. We must have something to defend ourselves. And lo and behold, riding out of the West came the Patriot missile. And it started to shoot these things out of the sky. And yes, sure, there was debris. And yes, there were casualties caused. And yes, perhaps you can have a better weapon. But the key point about the Patriot was that it kept Israel out of the war. And it provided the psychological reassurance that was absolutely right and absolutely necessary at that time.
Now, let me ask you about arms control. There are treaties that limit the proliferation of chemical and nuclear weapons, ballistics. Where do smart weapons fit into that?
They don't really, because there is no limitation in... People don't look at, really, guidance. They look at performance in terms of distance or in terms of payload, which... Actually, it's an interesting question because there is a common misconception, I think, that warfare carried out with nuclear weapons, whether they be tactical or rather larger, or carried out with chemical weapons is somehow dirty, and war carried out by conventional means is somehow really rather nice. And I just think this is completely crazy. War carried out with conventional weapons these days, because they are so smart, because explosives, conventional explosives, are so much more powerful than they were 10, 20 years ago, conventional warfare is an unbelievably brutal and terrible business. And limiting tactical nuclear weapons is great. Of course you should limit tactical nuclear weapons, but conventional weapons these days are horrific. And you have to really address that issue as well if you're serious about arms control. But sadly, somehow people just don't seem to hoist this on board, and that is an effect that is an image, in fact, that has been perpetuated by the Gulf War, where if you ask anyone, okay, what was the war like, and they'll say it was a precision clean war, and how many people's bodies did we see blown to pieces? Answer, mostly we didn't see any. And yet there were, depending on who you speak to, 50,000, 100,000, maybe more Iraqis killed. And being killed in war is not a pleasant experience. And yet we've got this completely artificial impression of what war is about, which makes, of course, the whole issue of arms control much more difficult, because people think, hey, it's okay, really, which, of course, it isn't.
Do you think that these new smart weapons should be included in arms control treaties?
I don't think it's so much an issue of smart weapons, because you would have an impossible definitional problem of saying, well, what's a smart and what's a stupid weapon, and should this particular bullet that does this particular type of thing be included in or not? The issue is not that. It is the fact of arms control at all levels that is important, not really so much whether this does this or this does the other. You have to somehow do enough to persuade the arms-producing nations not to sell to anybody, and the arms-buying nations to be restricted on how much they can actually purchase. And it's doing that that matters, not so much saying, well, this is a good weapon, or this isn't, or this should be restricted, or that shouldn't. But it's dealing with the whole range of problems raised by proliferation.
Well, it sounds like a lot of Western democracies aren't interested in seeing that kind of conventional arms control because of the political and economic advantages they think they get out of selling weapons to other countries.
I think there's some truth to that. I mean, there has been talk, as I'm sure you know, in the Bush administration and among other allies of the United States, such as Britain and France, where in the euphoria and immediately after the war, people were talking about reducing the amount of weapons that are sold conventionally and in every other area by saying, okay, we, perhaps the UN Security Council, will all sign up to a new level of a lower level of arms sales, and we will police it. And there was a lot of optimistic talk, but now that things have settled down a bit and it's getting back to more business as usual, there's been less of this. And the longer you wait, the less likely it is that anything is going to happen, and the more greed will come to the fore, and people want to sell everything they can to anyone. So I think it's rather depressing, but there does seem to have been an opportunity that looks like being lost. And it was, I would think, a once-in-our-lifetime opportunity where there was leadership from the United States, there were countries prepared to do things, and one doesn't really see any sign of that being built on, which is a great tragedy for which our children and our children's children will probably have to pay a rather heavy price.
James Adams is defense correspondent for the Sunday Times of London and author of the book Engines of War. He spoke to us from the NPR Bureau in London. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.